Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day from the University of Life, and him, Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. And guess what, Kieran? It's our 100th episode.
I know, it's really exciting.
It is, yeah. You notice I left a pause there, Kieran, because I think producer Guy will probably add in fireworks and celebration sound effects, although I suspect our listeners will simply be saying, what was that long silence about?
Well, it was really good to get the email from producer Guy telling us it was the 100th, and his idea of turning it into a bit like Pointless, where Alexander Armstrong and Richard Osman swap positions, so I'm asking the questions and you're answering them.
Yeah, and the only trouble is I know how much those two get paid for doing Pointless, so that's a very unfortunate analogy, actually, Kieran. Yes, but 100 episodes, which I'm rather proud of, to be perfectly honest, and what better way to celebrate such a significant milestone than with an unexpected lockdown and an interview with the commercial director at Watford. We spoke to Paul O'Brien about the challenges he faces right now, and I think it's fair to say, Kieran, it was a very illuminating interview and a very interesting to hear somebody who loves a club actually work for it.
Yeah, it must be quite a challenge in some way when you're a fan and you end up working for the club that you love. And listening to Paul, yeah, that has positives and negatives because you can't switch off because it's your club in two ways, of course.
Yeah. Anyway, so it's Thursday, Kieran, so that's news day. And guess what? Despite our efforts over 100 pods, the news keeps happening. It's amazing, isn't it? We thought we would have it resolved by pod 60, but there you go. There's another lockdown in England, as we know, Kieran, which starts today. Any news yet, though, on what will happen to non-league football in the next 4 weeks?
Well, what the government has done is that it's split non-league football into elite and non-elite. So the elite consists of National League, National League North and National League South. Now, those are the clubs that have received lottery funding. Yeah. Those matches are able to take place, as is the FA Cup first round, even if you're not an elite club. But everything below that tier has to now cease, which is very paradoxical because those are the matches to which fans have been attending. Socially distanced, no impact at all upon our rates, infection rates and so on. And, you know, speaking as somebody that's been to a few of them, you come out of it feeling quite good. So it does seem rather strange. And when it comes to women's football, the WSL is deemed to be elite. I think it's WSL 1 and 2. So I live in Sussex, as you know. I live quite close to Lewis. So this now means that Lewis's women's team, their matches can take place, but the men's team can't because Lewis women's team are deemed to be elite and the men's not elite. So it makes it really frustrating if you're trying to run the club, trying to generate any money, that there are these huge inconsistencies taking place.
Well, huge inconsistencies is probably what you'd expect. The only consolation is that the noises are that this lockdown will only last for just about 4 weeks, so they can at least plan for coming out of this short tunnel, can't they?
Well, that's the hope. And remember, for all those clubs that are non-elite, I appreciate the players are probably on boot money, so furlough will kick in and things of that nature, but they've still got other bills to pay. They've still got rent and rates and so on. And unless they can get some form of support for that, there's a genuine chance of quite a few clubs going to the wall, which if you're coming back to nothing, then you've got to think about what is the purpose of it all.
We've got more sort of lockdown finance stories to talk about, but I wanted to move this story up a little bit because it relates to something that we will be asking Paul O'Brien, the Watford commercial director, although I should say we did ask because we do mess with people's minds with the tenses on this, don't we? We've got an interview coming up that we've already done. I say so. This is a very interesting one because we've kind of predicted this would happen to English football in the near future, but it's happening in Spain now because La Liga clubs have been told to cancel all sponsorship deals with betting companies by the end of the season. Was this unexpected?
I don't think so. There's certainly been noises coming from Spanish politicians that this would be the case. And it is noticeable that it is the government which is taking the lead on this. Once again, football failing to regulate itself in a way that many other people find acceptable. So in Spain, yeah, this is worth around about €90 million a year to clubs. Seven clubs out of 20 in La Liga are sponsored front of shirt by betting companies. Now, when you then start to go into the small print, you've got the likes of Real Madrid, who also have overseas sponsors on a local basis. I think those deals will still carry through. La Liga itself has a sponsorship deal with a betting organization, which is going to have to cancel. You do feel an element of sympathy for the clubs because everybody's desperate for cash at present. But then some of the other things you're hearing, I don't know whether you're aware that Bristol City, their sponsors, they've been handing out leaflets to people. Yeah. Bet £10, win 20, or something of this nature. If that leaflet comes through your door and you've got a betting problem and it's the name of one of the local football clubs and you're already in a dark place, it's not going to help. And some of the stories I've been reading in the last couple of months, Paddy Power was paying people commission to introduce them to problem gamblers. So yeah, that really does not reflect well on the industry. You've got Paddy Power and Ladbrokes who found somebody who'd picked up £500,000 from a medical negligence case, and that £500,000 went into their pockets. And when things of this nature do arise, those people who are cheerleaders for the betting industry in football, I think they've got, they're skating on thin ice. Responsible gambling can take place. I'm not denying that, but some of the strategies being used by the gambling companies really paint it in a dark light.
Yeah, well, the sponsors of Bristol City really haven't done themselves any favours because the leaflets are actually quite funny in a way. It's a sort of Paddy Power approach. They take the mickey out of Bristol Rovers a little bit and some other West Country clubs. But as many people have pointed out, if you're just going back into lockdown and you're furloughed or you've lost your cash in hand job and you get a leaflet that's offering a cheap way of doubling your money, this is a time when you think, I really need money, and you're going to see that as an incentive, and it's just not right. The timing's the timing's never right, but I just thought that was a very poor piece of work. Back into the world of bailouts and lockdowns, the Premier League has agreed to help Championship clubs, but only those who can prove that they are in need. Is this going to lead to some creative accounting, Kieran?
Well, I think the creative accounting has already taken place. I mean, the good news is this is on top of League One and League Two's £50 million loan stroke grant offer. So it is going to be ring-fenced separately to that. Looking at clubs in the Championship, you can see where the Premier League is coming from. If I was Steve Parish, I wouldn't be happy about money which had been earned by my club going to necessarily a club such as Stoke City, where they're owned by Bet365, sort of tying into our last story. Bet365, incredibly successful business. So it doesn't need financial help. So a one-size-fits-all solution didn't really make sense to me. There's seven clubs in receipt of parachute payments. There's two clubs in the Championship that refuse to publish their accounts. So we don't know what the state of their finances are. And they're doing that because they're in dispute with the EFL about something else. There's loads of clubs who are paying wages which are not sustainable. You've got Sheffield Wednesday, Derby, Birmingham, Reading. All of those clubs have sold their stadiums to the club owners. So if they can afford to do that and get money from the club owners, do they need to get money from the likes of Brighton, Palace, Burnley and so on, who aren't hugely rich clubs to begin with? At the same time, Millwall, Luton, Rotherham, there are plenty of clubs who have come up from League One who probably are in need of assistance. So the devil's always in the detail, but this does seem to have some merit, and it is showing that the Premier League is not ignoring other clubs in need.
Premier League clubs also want to scrap pay-per-view broadcasts during lockdown. Is this another piece of evidence for my theory that it wasn't the Premier League clubs that were particularly keen on pay-per-view broadcasts in the first place?
I think that they were keen, but they weren't keen on pissing off all of their fan base by charging 15 quid a pop.
Right.
I mean, I went on Sunday night to a screening of our pay-per-view match at the Amex, which is, you know, one of these ludicrous things that I can attend a football match indoors with loads of other people around me, but I can't physically go to myself. And that actually worked really well. But again, it's the thing which we've been saying is that football for us is being with like-minded people. And it was a good, it was 20 quid, but for that you got a drink, a pint, a pie, and more food at half time. So you're actually getting quite something back. And everybody was socially distanced, no more than six people on a table. You had to be in bubbles and so on. So that worked quite well. They even had a competition whereby you could design a pie, you know, and one of them got chosen. Sadly, my camembert and chicken was not top of the list, so nobody got an opportunity to try out my cheesy cock that night.
Was that whole thing a build up to get a cheesy cock joke in?
Absolutely. Well, you know, I'm 12.
Really, I do know. Yeah, I was through my head. I was thinking crab. There's going to be a crab in this pie somewhere. which, it being Brighton, it probably would have been. I imagine the winner was a sort of lobster and scampi affair. Was it?
That's right.
So, did you enjoy this? There was a worrying moment there, Kieran, when I checked the scores and you weren't losing. So that annoyed me. But then, luckily, natural justice.
Because I was able to abuse the television in a way I would be along with two hundred other people when Harry Kane made that back. You know, it was Glenn Murray-esque in the way that he created that free kick. So an opportunity to abuse referees, abuse the opposition, and so on. That's what we go to football for. But I guess getting back to pay-per-view, there is now a school of thought that let's just bin the whole thing off. One of the issues that we'll probably be talking to Paul about is, should they give it away for nothing? Because if you do, I'm not certain that fans will then ever agree to some form of pay-per-view, or perhaps they should just reduce the price to something which makes far more common sense.
Yeah, it's good of you to speculate what we might be talking to Paul about, considering that we did talk to him about it about 10 minutes ago. So I never know what to do with the spoiler alerts on this thing. Still with the Premier League, surprise, surprise, the Premier League want to bypass the FA with special visas for foreign players post-Brexit. Now, if we could avoid the sort of special visas you've had in your travels, I'd be most grateful. But I think this is something we predicted, didn't we, that the FA would, or the Premier League rather, would find a way around any Brexit-related rules to stop them importing top players.
Well, that's what they want to do. I mean, the Premier League want to be in a position whereby under the Brexit clause that's going to be introduced, you can only join the Premier League if you are an existing international. That will be based on your FIFA ranking, looking at your existing salary, number of matches in the last year, and so on and so forth. So this would mean that there will be a global approach to recruiting overseas players, which would mean that the likes of David De Gea wouldn't qualify, and so on. Should they have been picked up at that time? So you can see the frustration from the Premier League club's perspective. But this is a classic case. We've got three governing bodies in English football. We've got the Premier League, who doesn't give a stuff about the national team and therefore it wants to do what's best for the Premier League on an individual club basis. We understand that. The clubs in the EFL, they're not particularly bothered one way or the other, because the vast majority of players that they recruit tend to be domestic anyway. So, you know, they'll go with the flow. And then you've got the FA, which wants to give this a big thumbs down because they feel that by recruiting players from overseas, it reduces opportunities for domestic players. The evidence of that is uncertain, because you look at the likes of Brazil and Argentina, you know, they export all of their players and they don't have an issue. So we'll have to wait and see. But the Premier League is trying, as part of things such as the financial support for the EFL, it can now go to the government and say, look, we've bailed out our own industry. We've not used the furlough. We've been good guys through doing X, Y, and Z. Give us some slack when it comes to EU visas.
Now, Kieran, I'm not saying I wasn't 100% committed to listening to that answer, because of course I was, but what was the winning pyre? Can you remember?
It was gammon and leek.
Yeah, of course it was. Thank you. I'm really pleased about that. If it had been some kind of steak-based working-class thing, I'd have been furious. Now, Kieran, this week, Kieran saw the sad news that Sir Bobby Charlton has been diagnosed with dementia, but that just lends weight to the PFA supporting a request to classify dementia as an industrial disease in football, which would entitle affected players to financial support. And the PFA have helped fund research this. I mean, it's a very laudable idea, but it strikes me it's very difficult to prove, isn't it, Kieran? Even for footballers of Sir Bobby's generation who spent half their life heading very heavy objects.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it is a delicate subject. Anybody that's ever had relatives or friends suffer dementia, and I mean, the Baroness's mum had it, and I saw the deterioration of a person from the inside is a horrible thing to observe.
Yeah.
But I think we've now seen both Charlton brothers, Nobby Stiles, Martin Peters, you know, all England World Cup heroes of 66, all succumbed to this horrendous disease. There was a study done by the University of Glasgow. If you are an ex-professional footballer, you are 3.5 times more likely to get dementia.
Really?
Now,
okay.
So whether that is due to your career, or whether it's due to the fact that the adrenaline that you have during your career to a certain extent drops off. Yeah, there's not definitive proof that it was heading the ball. But the PFA, you know, they are potentially going to be sort of demanding annual screenings for their members. And if so, I think both the Premier League and the EFL should agree to this. If it is classified as an industrial disease, it means that they're entitled to the industrial injuries disablement benefit, which and people will say, well, footballers, you know, they don't need benefits, they're rich. If you were playing in the 60s and the 70s, especially if you were playing in the lower leagues, you were not earning big money.
Absolutely.
And it's certainly gone by the time they retired. Looking over the pond, and we've often said that, sort of much to our shame, because we like to take the moral high ground here, in the NFL, they've set up a concussion settlement fund for former players, because clearly, yeah, that's a pretty wild sport when it comes to knocking heads. And they've put in over $800 million into that fund to provide compensation and, you know, to provide for healthcare for former players. Now, you know, $800 million in the States doesn't go very far, given the nature of their healthcare system, but at least it's a step in the right direction. Looking at the PFA itself, I know they're saying the right things, but perhaps they could be doing a bit more. I took a look at the PFA charity accounts yesterday morning. In the last 2 years, they have a total income of £54 million. Gordon Taylor has trousered over £4 million, and dementia and concussion research, $300,000.
Oh, is that all?
Yeah. So it doesn't look great, does it? And look, the PFA does lots and lots of good stuff to lots and lots of good causes.
Yeah, of course.
But this is in respect of their members, and I think their members should be a priority.
Well, they should do. I mean, the difference between that $4 million and $300,000 is ludicrous, really, isn't it? Especially when they're publicly calling for funds to research into this. That's disappointing to hear. Now, Kieran, we've talked quite a lot on this pod about possibly doing a top 10 wrong-uns pod, and the idea has been very popular. But quite a few people have said, well, you know, for reasons of karma, why don't we do a top 10 right-uns pod as well? And that's right-uns, not Brighton's, by the way, for anybody listening. And I think if we were to do a top 10 right-uns pod, Accrington Stanley would be very highly featured. And they've decided to refund 50% of season ticket money they've received for the season so far.
That's right, and that's pretty damn decent of a club, because we know that clubs in League One and Two are so much more reliant upon match day income. But what Stanley did was, as soon as the lockdown was announced, they said, well, we can't morally keep that money ourselves.
Yeah.
So, Andy Holt, who is one of my heroes, if ever you met Andy or heard him, he is so down to earth, and he is straight down the line as well. Yeah, there's no messing around with Andy. They've said to their fans, we give you half your money back straight away. You know, we might have to give you more back before the end of the season if no matches are taking place and so on. But I think it's a really good gesture from the club, because it knows that its fan base is local, it is working class, it is many people who have been furloughed, lost their jobs and so on. And just before Christmas, an opportunity to help people in need is very laudable.
Now, this is something we may well talk to Paul O'Brien about. We'll definitely talk to Paul O'Brien about. Me and around 15,000 other people bought Palace season tickets this season. We agreed with Steve Parish's logic. It seems increasingly unlikely that me or any of the other 15,000 people will see a Palace game this season. Does that mean the free season tickets that we will get next year, which we've been promised, will presumably be kicking a cash flow problem down the road for Palace for quite some time, won't it?
Yeah, I mean, this will unravel over a long period. Clearly, many clubs need cash now. So if fans, either through wanting to defer that refund or out of love of their club, they choose to do so, then that will certainly help out individual clubs. Ultimately, you've not received any football this year, Kevin, so you're going to get your money back in some way, shape or form, which will cause a cash flow problem for you and diminish a cash flow problem for the club.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk. We've mentioned Paul O'Brien quite a lot now, and I think we've covered some of the subjects we're going to talk to him about. You'd imagine, Kieran, that being the commercial director of a Premier League football club is quite a cushy number. Being the commercial director of a team recently relegated from the Premier League during a global pandemic must be far from easy, especially if you're a massive fan of that club. And earlier we spoke to Paul O'Brien, who has that very task at Watford.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Paul, thank you very much for joining us. And before we talk about the world turning upside down, tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to Watford and what your job entails.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. Mine is a little bit of a strange story. I didn't come the conventional way. I started my life. I come from extremely working class family. My stepfather thinks that you get a job when you're 16 and that's your job for life. So he was a mechanic. My brother became a mechanic. When I went home and told him I've been accepted into sixth form, he wasn't too impressed, because not really what happened in our world. So I went out, I became a panel beater, and the deal I had with my mum and stepfather is that when I get my papers, I can do what I like. So for 3 years, I was a panel beater. And the day I got my papers through, I handed in my notice and then started working at first. It's still in the car industry, but selling car parts. Then ended up at Vauxhall's, ended up in a sales department at Vauxhall's, worked into marketing. And then I met by accident, really, a long time ago, a chap called Richard Busby, who owns quite a large sponsorship agency in London. And he was looking for someone outside of the industry to come in, and it fitted quite nicely to go in there. Maybe not as my personal life. I'd just become a father for the first time quite young. So it was a bit of a leap of faith to jump onto a train into London every day. But it taught me a lot. I worked from the bottom to account director from there. One of our clients, at first when I joined, we didn't do much sponsorship in sport. It was a lot of arts, a lot of venues. And then we had Saracens as a client. And it meant I would go along to the home games at Saracen. And I fell in love with just the event side of it and how all week sort of gears to in rugby. It was a Sunday. I then got approached by a rugby club called London Welsh. They'd just been re-promoted to the Premiership. I went there, and the brief was, well, the idea was that they were going to be a bit similar to Exeter have done and Bristol have done in rugby. They were going to defy the odds, and they were going to stay up and challenge. Well, that season, we didn't get a point. We got 1 point. We got a bonus point loss, but we didn't win one game. So if anything was going to teach me how to sell hospitality or sponsorship or tickets in a season, that really was a tough season. But it was great fun as well, and I learned quite a lot in there. I left there to join another rugby club, in London Irish, and I was very happy. And I was driving home one day, and I got a call from a recruiter who said, there is a football club looking, and your name's been mentioned. And I said, no, I'm sorry, I'm not interested. I'm really happy where I am. And then he said, well, just before you go, it's Watford. Well, I was a Watford season ticket holder. Wow. And then it suddenly all clicked in. And then the process to get the job lasted about a month. But it was the longest month of my life, I think, because suddenly I'd gone from not being interested to being desperate to get the job. And I remember the first day I walked in here, just being so delighted to be here and feeling it was the right move for me. And that was 5 years ago. And apart from a couple of times last season, I've loved every minute of it. So it's good fun. And I could go and get a proper job if I wanted to, but instead I'll do this.
Well, do you know what, Paul? I wasn't expecting that answer to that. I don't know what I was expecting, but no, it's a brilliant answer. It just goes to prove the wide diversity of people who work in football and the circumstances by which you got the job. And both Kieran and I are very proud of our working class backgrounds. We play a little game as to who's more working class than the other. We call it Prolier Than Now. But it's lovely to have somebody like you join around and to join your club. So tell us a little bit about what you do at Watford. And I presume the difference between working for a rugby club and working for a Premier League football club, as it was, is one of scale and finance, is it?
Yeah, I think the truth is in when you're selling anything, people buy off people. So you keep the relationships as close as you can. I have a great relationship with all of our partners, our hospitality clients. You have to keep those relationships really tight. And that has really helped out in the last 6 months. The last 6 months has been hard, but I think a lot of the, not just me, but a lot of the work we've done here behind the scenes of how close we are to our partners has really, really come through. And our partners have been incredibly supportive in the last 6 months. You're right. The scale is the same sort of role, just the scale's different. Like I remember a couple of years ago looking at the Premier League attracted a 3.2 billion global audience. And it's a fantastic thing to go out and sell. But it's no different selling that to what I was selling in rugby or selling a sponsorship agency or even selling now at the EFL. The only difference is the decimal points in a different place. Mm. But you still go with the same selling tactic as well. And the thing that I've always been keen on here and in any part, and at the minute it's tough, but not to join in on that race to the bottom. So you don't negotiate hard because your brand is more important than anything here. And at the moment, we're being offered silly deals. And I agreed a deal for a second tier partner 2 weeks ago, and they've just kept coming back and coming back, trying to chip us down on price. And we've walked away from it because we don't want to join in on this race to the bottom. Because once you get there, it's very, very hard to get back.
I was going to say, Kieran, that's quite a risky policy, isn't it, really? If you at this stage of the pandemic, if you're being offered any sort of money, the temptation must be to take it, I guess.
There is that. It depends how desperate for cash you are. But I think Paul's totally right in the approach that he's taking. Once you've given the brand away for nothing, and remember, I think this is also linked to pay-per-view to a certain extent, it's actually very difficult to then to negotiate your price upwards, because they turn around and say to you, well, hold on, 12 months ago you were asking X and now you're asking 3X. Mm. We're not getting 3X from ourselves. So I think it is the approach to take. I've spoken to other commercial directors who have said it can be a bun fight at times, but I do totally support the strategy that Paul's employing at Watford.
Paul, to go back on it, that's not a strategy just for me. That comes from a very top. Our chairman's very keen on not. We have a strategy in place and not going away from that strategy. And an example from this, and without going into granular details, we was pitched something about a month ago, a deal. I came back with a figure it dried in mind, and then they came back and they said, well, we can get it from another club 90% cheaper. Wow. And I said, well, good. Yeah. Greatest respect. Good luck to them.
Yeah.
And they said that they wanted Watford because we'll be on TV more and we should be a top six club. Yeah, that's why you pay more. And that's really our process we're going through here. We just, as Kieran says, we're not going to, if you give a brand away, then it's very difficult to get it back down the line.
You mentioned that you enjoyed last season, apart from a couple of moments. Obviously, is a possible relegation, especially when it's unexpected for a club like Watford, is that the sort of thing you factor in at the start of a season, or do you just sort of go, uh-oh, around about February?
And we factored in a relegation, what I'd never factored in, and I imagine what another 92 clubs in factoring, is that we wouldn't have any attendance for a year.
Yeah.
And something we've always looked at is what happens when the broadcasting money comes down, what that effect that would have to the football club. And we've been doing that for years, but I never sat there for 1 minute and thought, what would happen if we didn't have anyone in our stadium for a year?
Yeah.
And that came really out of the blue, as it did for everyone. But the cocktail of relegation and COVID has been very hard.
Yeah. I mean, does it sort of just drive a lot of your traffic online, basically? I mean, are you still able to, for want of a better word, sell products, but you just can't do it around the ground, so you have to do it in more imaginative ways?
In retail has obviously gone online, so we've had to close down both stores this week or tonight. But that will all go online. Our online the traffic's been picking up a lot in the last couple of years anyway. So, yes, that's online. Regarding partnerships, yes, we've just brought on a new digital agency really to help put a bit more core competence into the digital sponsorships. We've just signed with a company called Rivals, who are a big US esports platform, to create a white label platform for us, which is going to be the Watford esports community. And there's some great opportunities for sponsorship there. So, yeah, there has been opportunities digitally. All of our network's gone digitally as well. We were doing a beanbags, which a lot of clubs, and I see Brighton and Palace have been doing them as well. But obviously that's had to stop now, which was a shame, because we were really happy with ours. And that's been a bit of a kick in the teeth, but we understand why it's had to stop.
Now, obviously, Kieran supports a kind of small regional team, but yeah, you're a Watford fan. You work for Watford. I'm a Palace fan. So our clubs are of a similar size. And I guess more of our fans are based in South London and Hertfordshire rather than America or Malaysia. Does that make your job harder in terms of attracting advertising and sponsorship? Or does a passionate local crowd have its own appeal to various companies?
I think this goes back to your scale question from the start. when you're talking about the second tier partners, people are sponsoring us because we are Watford. When it comes to the front of shirts, the sleeve, this is in the Premier League, the sleeve and the technical partner, that's because it's EPL and it's the huge global audience which it brings. I know you talk about this a lot on your podcast, but people, when you go overseas, people don't say they're Watford fans or Palace fans or Brighton fans. They are Premier League fans. That and people follow the Premier League, and it's so we do have we're starting to get more and more fans overseas, and we've done a huge amount of work for that. America's got our second highest amount of fan base. We partner with American Airlines, who are really helping us drive more bigger fan base in there. Obviously, Premier League really helped that as well. But to answer your question, it is a mixture of both. And I think Palace have done really well on that. I know the commercial director really well there. He's a really good guy. And they've done well to get those local brands on board, but also the more global brands coming as well. And I'd say we've done the same really over the last few years.
It's a difficult balancing act, isn't it? Because you know what football fans are like. They can be very parochial. So there's that worry for some of them that the more global brands you attract, the more the local fan feels left out. And I think that's something that Liverpool, for example, are starting to feel. And I think it's something that your club and my club do very well. But it's something you need to be aware of, isn't it? That keeping that relationship with the people who come to see you week in, week out.
So, yeah, we have a data agency and we did a survey of our season ticket holders, or a partnerships survey, and it was really interesting findings. And one of the questions was, what do you want out of a partnership? Whether it was giveaways, whether it was a local brand, whether all of these questions. But the one that came out, and one by some way, I think it's got about 75% of the vote, was just a financial payment to the club, the biggest financial payment you can do. So, which surprised me because, yeah, we've been accused of that. Obviously, we, like Palace, have a betting partner on the front of a shirt as well, which we're a family club. But I think our fans have been quite accepting of that. And I mentioned AA a minute ago, American Airlines a minute ago, but one of the first things they did when they sponsored a club is they did a competition where they were giving away free flights around the world to, I think it was any location you wanted where they flew to. So they were trying to, they got into the fans very quickly there, which does help when the season ticket holders get a chance to fly to Hawaii free of charge.
Yeah, I'm sure Kieran's managed to get free flights to Hawaii somewhere. That's definitely on your list of exotic locations where you've had girlfriends, Kieran, isn't it?
Possibly, yeah. Kevin.
You mentioned that the gambling sponsorship on the front of your shirt, it's on the front of Palace's shirt and many others. Presumably you've kept an eye on the news from Spain where they're banning all betting sponsorship by the end of the season. Is that something that you're slightly anxious about? Because we've already seen a House of Lords committee suggesting similar here. That's notwithstanding the moral issues of gambling, which is a completely different issue. There's a lot of clubs will take a big hit if that's a rule that's instigated in this country, isn't it? Won't they?
So our sister club is Udinese in Serie A, who have had this for the last few years as well. So yeah. we completely understand. Well, I say we understand. It will be an interesting one. It will be an interesting one how it is governed, and if somebody's got a 10-year deal with a betting partner on the front of a shirt now, does that mean they can keep it for the next 10 years as long as that contract is in play? So it'll be interesting. But yeah, does it make me anxious? Not really. It just changes the way we sell. I think that's not what's keeping me up at night. And it's just how we sell. And it does change the landscape of front of shirt sponsors. Yeah, time will tell there, but it's been discussed for a long time, hasn't it? Labour Party put it on their manifesto in the last election. So we've been across it for some time.
This is not a question I can ever ask Kieran. So what is keeping you up at night other than the pandemic?
I've It's funny, I was just chatting to my head of communications about this. It just as I'm falling asleep, something comes into my head thinking, oh, I'd never reply to that person today.
Oh, really?
So I do. At 11 o'clock, and then I'm wide awake for the next couple of hours. So, the pandemic, obviously, the quicker we can get fans back into a stadium in a safe environment, the better for everyone, really. That would help me sleep at night.
Do you feel more responsibility then working for the club that you support and that you love? Right, so it's obviously more than just a job for you, isn't it? So do you think somebody who doesn't support Watford would be more able to switch off when they walk away in the evening?
I feel it's a really good question. I never thought about it. I think that the person who ultimately I need to look in the mirror at the end of the day and think, did I do a good enough job today for my club? And whether it's because I support the club or whether it's because this club's been very good to me over the last 5 years and in my lifetime, I don't know the answer to that, because I can't remember what it was like when I didn't work for a club. Now it feels like such a long time, but yeah, there's definitely a sense of that I want to do right for the club long term, not just short term. And maybe if I felt I'm going to work here for a year, then go somewhere else for a year and something, I wouldn't feel like that. But in every decision we make, and I keep saying I, and it's not I, so it's a we here.
Of course, we
work really closely with all departments. But in every decision we make, it needs to be for a long term future of this football club, not just because it suits me.
And speaking of the long term future, are you able to plan already for next season? Once this is over, do you expect that you would bounce back commercially very quickly?
Yes, I do actually. Growing up as a Watford fan, I shouldn't be confident, because I've spent most of my supporting life in this division. And as you guys know, it's not the easiest division to get out of.
Yeah.
But I am confident we'll get out. So the plans are already in place for next season. And what we've tried to do here, really, 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 really tried, and it is tough in this environment, is not to kick the can down the road. So we didn't sell season tickets. We're one of a few who didn't in this league. So it was we did a secure seat, £20, and then it was going to be a match day buy under these while we were in restricted attendances. So the good thing about that is, as long as we get 5, 6, 7 games this season, we won't need to kick the can down the road at all for the 21-22 season, which means, although this is absolute hell of a year, I believe we'll come out stronger.
Paul, let's finish. As you're a Watford fan, let's do what we very rarely get a chance to do on this pod, which upsets me a little, and actually talk about football, because you've made a decent start. You've got a big game tonight against Stoke. I think that in Truce Dekong and João Pedro, you've got two of the most exciting players in that division. And considering one of them's a defender, that's a big that's a big thing to say. I think you look a really good team to watch, and you look well placed, don't you, to bounce back?
I think so. You look down through our squad, the quality is incredible. It's tough, because it's normally in a championship, as you guys know, it's a lot of Tuesday nights, Saturday, Tuesday. Well, it's even worse this season because it's a truncated season. So the thing which I think Vlad has to get right this season is going to be the chopping and changing, because he's going to have to rest players. But we have such a large squad, that shouldn't be a problem. That said, going to Wickham last week and then Barnsley, those are ones you sort of look at on paper and you think, well, we should be winning those games. But it's not like that in the Championship. And they are tough games. And every team we play, I sort of look down the list and think, he's a good player. He's a good player. He's a good player. So there's a lot of quality in this league, and it's proven. I actually can't remember the last team before Fulham who bounced straight back up, and it was Newcastle United. And I believe they lost 10 or 11 games that season. So it shows that it's really dog-eat-dog in this league. So, but tonight's a tough game. might suit us a bit better against Stoke, actually, and we'll see. And then we've got Coventry before the international break. So if we do hit 6 points, in the next few days, then I'll be very happy with that going into the international break.
You've also got ex-Palace and Brighton legend Glenn Murray. I nearly made him smile once. It's one of my proudest moments. He's a taciturn lad, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a great guy. He's a great guy.
He's a very good guy, but he's almost comically pessimistic, which I like about him.
Yeah, I haven't got to know him very well here, because we're in different bubbles, actually, from a stadium to a training ground. So,
Of course.
Yeah, it's not as easy as it normally is, but I know he's a very popular guy, a lad. So, it's great to have him here. But obviously he paid for both of you two, didn't he? So.
He did, and it's hard to tell, Kieran, which club he was more of a legend for. I mean, probably the FFS Murray is still one of a lot of tattoos that Palace fans have still got. So I think maybe we edge it. Paul, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. It's really interesting to talk to somebody who's a passionate fan of the club and working for the club as well. And it's been a really interesting insight into the difficulties you're working with at the moment. But it's nice to hear you be optimistic about next season and how you hope to bounce back both football-wise and commercially. So thanks for your time. I really appreciate that.
Well, it's a pleasure to be invited on, actually. And I must say, you two, it's a great listen. I pass off so much information that you say as my own. So you help my career. And it is a good listen. Actually, whoever starts here, I make them read Kieran's book as well. So maybe that's why we're getting a bit of a churn on staff at the minute. But it's great what you two are doing.
Well, you could make them read my book as well, except not the Watford chapter, probably for the best.
I haven't come across that one actually yet, but
My book's called "Who Are You?" It's a left field comedy history of 92 football clubs, and I wrote the Watford chapter after coming back from a particularly bad tempered 0-0 draw and drinking all the way home on the train, and it was the only chapter the editor suggested I rewrite.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah,
okay.
That's good. It's a proper history. It's a proper history of your club. And also, I love the fact that you pass off information from Kieran as your own, because I literally forget everything he tells me the minute I walk away from the post. It's shocking. People stop me in the street and say, "Can you tell me anything about Newcastle's amortisation price?" I'm like, "What? No, I can't, mate. You'll have to tweet Kieran, he'll tell you." But it's been a real pleasure talking to you, Paul, and genuinely wish Watford the best of luck for the coming season.
Thanks, guys. Really enjoyed it.
That was, I found that a really illuminating interview, Kieran, especially that refusal to be, you know, driven to the bottom, basically, to allow companies, partners, potential sponsors to take advantage of the pandemic to drive very bad deals for the club and good deals for the sponsors.
Yeah, once you're in a bad deal, it takes a hell of a lot of time to get out of it. So, and I'm sure, you know, the fact that Paul's got backing from his chief executive as well, you know, they know what they consider to be the value of the club as a brand, as a commercial partner. This is, for me, textbook. You know, when I'm listening to my marketing colleagues teaching on the MBA course, he's doing exactly the right thing here.
Yeah, speaking of textbook, I was slightly annoyed that he'd heard of your book but not heard of mine. That was a bit of a blow to the confidence, Kieran, I have to say. But I hope you noticed that I went through an entire interview with somebody from Watford without mentioning the most annoying mascot in football. I'm not even going to name the buzzy little, but yeah. Anyway, three more stories to go, short stories. I know you've got to be somewhere else, Kieran. Of course you have. It's a Wednesday. Watford's spiritual home, of course, is Vicarage Road, and this week saw, in a rare piece of good news, the return of Wimbledon to Plough Lane. I know a lot of Wimbledon fans, Kieran, and there's been quite a few misty eyes around SW19 this week.
Yeah, and it's taken nearly 30 years. There's so many fans who won't have seen the club return and won't get the opportunity because of this long period. You've got to give the people at AFC Wimbledon a huge amount of credit that they've struggled to raise money at times, as a result of COVID, as a result of banks taking a dim view of football clubs. So they went through the Dons bond, the Wimbledon bond approach, which raised around about £4.5 million. I think a rich fan came in and chipped in another couple of a million. So they had their first match on Tuesday night against Doncaster. It was a shame that Doncaster got a 91st minute equaliser. Yeah. Otherwise, it would have been the perfect romantic tale. But Dickie Guy was there, Terry Gibson, John Scales. And I'm sure that for all of the Wimbledon fans who were watching it, the match in local pubs, because that's how I understand that they sort of filled out the locality and did a bit of cheering afterwards, will be desperate for this latest lockdown to end. And hopefully when it does end, the government will see a bit more sense and start to let fans in restricted numbers, using protocols and so on, as we've been saying from day one.
Yeah, as they seem to be doing in most Eastern European countries at the moment. It's terrifying to think that it's nearly 30 years it's taken them to get back to Plough Lane, because I compared the first ever fundraiser to raise money for the Phoenix Club, and that doesn't seem like 30 years ago. But I'm actually delighted. We have a strange relationship with Wimbledon fans because of their attitude when they share their ground, and you can't blame them in hindsight. But I don't think any football fan could be upset at seeing them back in their spiritual home. And hopefully there'll be Bury fans and Macclesfield fans listening to this who think that their day will come as well. Now, Kieran, two stories to get through quite quickly. The first one, I like this because Guy has put French newspaper Le Parisien. I don't know why producer Guy felt the need to add the French newspaper bit there. And unless, of course, there is a German newspaper that's somewhat disconcertingly called Le Parisien, but it's French news. I'm just merely reading what I could have cut it out when I wrote it out from his email, but I thought I'd leave it in just to so people know what we're dealing with here. But anyway, Le Parisien are reporting, and they're normally quite a reliable source. They're reporting that UEFA are considering making Russia the sole host of the Euros next year. Presumably this is just a contingency plan, Kieran, because you've still got a ticket for Wembley, haven't you?
I've got two tickets for Wembley and one for Dublin. I guess this is potentially UEFA looking at the scenario where they're going to want the competition to take place because they can't defer it another year because we're moving into World Cup.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've still got very, very big TV deals that they've signed, and they can't afford to give the money back. So this will, if you have a single country as a host, and the reason why Russia has been suggested was that it, of course, hosted the World Cup in 2018. So therefore, in theory, it has the infrastructure, it has the stadia, which are already compliant with FIFA in terms of size and so on. So we could squeeze it in. I don't think the Baroness would be over keen at me going back to Russia, if truth be told, with my tickets. The benefits would be single country. I think the downside is that if anybody's familiar with Russia, it is a damn big country. So it's not a case of just jumping on a train from one place to another. And then there would be what's going to happen to Dublin, Glasgow, London, Azerbaijan, Berlin, and all these other places where the countries have already effectively touted for the work and have committed to pay UEFA a hosting fee. So it will get messy. This is one thing in terms of consideration. And it is being driven by money because I think a lot of people would say, in the wider context of things, the players are going to be absolutely knackered by the end of this season.
Fair
because
point, yeah.
we're trying to squeeze in 10 months of football into 8 months, and they didn't have a proper break. So the standard of performance isn't going to be great. If it's taking place even at Russia in empty stadia, then you've got to ask yourself, what is the point? It's purely being driven by UEFA fearing to having to give huge rebates back to broadcasters.
Well, I was going to say, I'm guessing one of the reasons that they've chosen Russia now is because they are much further down the road towards getting people back in stadia than we are. Their test and tracing has been more effective than Western Europe. So maybe they think that a tournament, even if, as we say, God forbid, this is still going on next summer, they will at least be able to have some fans. And I think, don't worry about the Baroness. She respects my skills as a pub lawyer. I think she'll understand that, you know, it's legally binding that if your ticket is swapped, you have to go to Moscow. You'd be breaking the law not to go to Russia, Kieran, essentially.
Yeah, I think she's more concerned about me coming back alive, given that there's...
It's a big country, Kieran. I don't think that girl's brothers will be able to track you down, really.
It's her sister I'm worried about.
Oh, really? Her sister?
Oh, yeah.
We haven't got
yeah,
time.
That, yeah, got... the she told her sister that I'd been sent by God to make her happy.
Wow, that's a compliment, isn't it?
I'd
love to get that sort of review afterwards.
That's a lot of that from Edinburgh, have you?
Yeah, no, I haven't. That's or TripAdvisor. That's a really. You're sent by God to make it. Oh, well, there you go. I'm almost reluctant to ask the last question now, as it's going to be an anticlimax, is not the right word, is it, really? But it's the only one that came to my head. Mesut Ozil, we hailed him last week as a distributor of wealth by paying brilliantly for 1,400 school meals, free school meals for North London children. But rather bizarrely, he's now joined an American venture capital fund as an advisor. It's a strange story, Kieran.
It is. I think effectively he's a front man. You know, he will be shaking hands. This particular venture capital fund, which is looking at new tech companies and ideas in that nature, they've already got Serena Williams. They've got David Beckham as sort of ambassadors. And now Mesut Ozil, given that he's not spending a lot of time at training, has been signed up. So, you know, part of me says, well, you know, he's thinking outside of the box. He has been very generous with some of his money. You know, we've heard about Gunnosaurus and sponsoring all these meals. Yeah. So he is a guy with a social conscience. I think people get a bit upset about his wages too much. If somebody offers you a lot of money as a salary, here's my advice: take it. Nobody forced Arsenal to offer him that money in the first place. Yeah. But yeah, this is—he's a smart guy as well, so I think he's probably got something to offer. But I suspect his role will be more on the ambassadorial side rather than the funding itself.
Okay, Kieran, we do have to wrap up because I know you've got other media commitments. So we'll take the tawdry speech about the merchandise and about the five-star reviews as read this week, shall we? And we'll say that our next pod will be on Monday, and it's our usual questions pod. So if you've got questions about anything pertaining to some of the things we've talked about today, and I suspect Watford fans might have a few questions after the Paul O'Brien interview, then get in touch with us at questions@priceoffootball.com. In the meantime, enjoy your weekend of football, and we'll see you soon, Kieran. And let's for old time's sake, as we're back in lockdown, just have your usual old-fashioned two-word farewell.
Stay safe. The Price of Football.
Price of Football.